This is Aging Forward, a podcast from Mayo Clinic about geriatric medicine and the science of healthy aging. Each episode, we explore new ways to take care of ourselves, our loved ones, and our community so we can all live longer, fuller lives. I'm Dr. Christina Chen, a geriatrician and internist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. In this episode, we are talking about embracing endings with hope and reflection with our guest, Dr. Corey Ingram. Dr. Ingram is a palliative care physician at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's also a care provider for a loved one, and we are lucky enough to have him with us today. Welcome, Dr. Ingram, to the show.
Yeah,
lovely to have you here. What I really admire about Dr. Ingram is his unique ability to really provide tender and holistic care for his patients and families, weaving in dignity-conserving therapies and really helping people find their voice behind the disease, which I think is so powerful and really is transformative in the patient care experience. And through his palliative care practice has really helped a lot of people distill down to the purpose behind their existence until the very last breath. I just think it's so beautiful what you do.
That's very kind. Thank you.
So let's just start with a little bit of background here. We know that your focus is in hospice and palliative care. And just so we're aware of the difference here, hospice is typically referred for individuals with a limited life expectancy of less than 6 months if the disease were to take its natural course. And palliative care is a little bit different. It's more about bringing quality of life, symptom management for people with serious illness and chronic disease, not quite towards the point of hospice yet. Dr. Ingram, I think we would love to know about your journey towards hospice and palliative care as a career. How did you get to this point?
Well, it's a good question, because when I went to medical school, I didn't even know that there was such a specialty as hospice and palliative care. Hmm. And my real introduction was in my geriatrics fellowship, in which a 48-year-old lady came into my clinic one day. And we knew each other because she was a social worker in a local nursing home where I took care of a lot of patients. And she said to me, "Corey, you don't know this about me, but I have stage 4 ovarian cancer, and I want you to care for me through the rest of my life." And that was a pivotal moment, because in the weeks and months that followed, what she taught me was that I didn't have 3 essential things to provide her the care that she was requesting. And the 3 areas in which I was lacking was, one was skill, skill in communication, skill in symptom management, skill in even understanding how her disease might unfold fully, really specializing in how diseases come to their natural end. I was also fundamentally in the wrong role, because this care is best provided in a team effort. And as a primary care clinician in that situation, I didn't have a full team with me. And then lastly, I didn't have the time. Mm-hmm. And so skill, role, and time became elements that I recognized that I didn't have. And I set off on another leap of faith to say, "I'd like to go do another fellowship." Mm-hmm. And Mayo Clinic said, "Well, we'd like you to go do another fellowship in hospice and palliative care." And I completed that at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and then came back to Mayo and have been here ever since.
Thank you for sharing that journey. I think what you mentioned, the 3 skill sets, is something that all clinicians need, not just communication, but to really understand the person that you're taking care of in front of you. And how do you describe the philosophy of hospice and palliative care in a way that's not so threatening?
I think what people are experiencing in our society these days is that they're living with a higher burden of illness,
right,
in general. And they are also living with a significant burden of treatments oftentimes as well. Mm-hmm. And if we were just to remove the language of hospice and palliative care and we start to talk to people about how they're wanting to move forward and understanding their values and preferences and priorities for their care, then they start to describe things that sound an awfully lot like a hospice plan of care or a palliative care support structure. And the way that I look at palliative care is that hospice was a wonderful model of care for dying patients.
Yeah.
The problem was you have to be dying to get it. Mm-hmm. And that's why palliative care came into vogue and necessity, because the people who are not necessarily dying, they have a lot of the same burden, and that can be alleviated. Well, and that's really the history, you know, how it came to be, is because everybody said, well, hospice is so wonderful. Let's recognize that people with serious illness need the same sort of an interdisciplinary team to focus on symptoms and conversations and advanced care planning and those sorts of things.
So let's just get back to what we were talking about earlier about your philosophy of hospice and palliative care.
One of the things that I was asked a few years ago when Barbara Bush entered into hospice care, the news media said, Barbara Bush is no longer going to be receiving medical care. She's entering into hospice. Mm. And so I wrote a piece about that that I think helps articulate this a little bit, about the lessons that we could learn from Barbara Bush, and subsequently now we could learn from the Carter family as well. And I choose those families because they're well known.
Right.
But in the Bush family situation, the first lesson that we could learn is that people are more ill when they near the end of life these days. Mm-hmm. Things that would cause a person to die back when I was in medical school are fundamentally different than what causes them to die today. Today, right. They have multiple problems that are causing them to near the end of their life. And so the medical care at the end of life is really complex, and they need good medical support through the end. The other lesson that we could learn from Ms. Bush is that the best care possible is goal-directed based on their values and preferences and priorities. Mm-hmm. And so Mrs. Bush was choosing to have her care focused to ensure that she was comfortable and surrounded by family and well through the end of life. And some people might say, but on hospice care, she wouldn't have particular care modalities. Well, the best care possible, if it's goal-directed to the patient's values, preferences, and priorities, it includes diagnostics and therapeutics, but it has to be tailored to their goals and if it's going to help them.
Right.
And it also has to be coupled with their whole person experience, the emotional, spiritual, and social well-being of the patient and their family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to recognize, that the best care possible is something everybody wants, but it's also a shifting landscape.
Right.
As people experience the burden of illness and the burden of treatments. Mm-hmm. The last lesson that we could learn from Mrs. Bush is that goals change over time. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm a hospice and palliative care doctor, I'm also a primary caregiver. Mm-hmm. My father, who's on hospice today, he entered into hospice several weeks ago.
Wow.
And you could say, well, what prompted us to enter into hospice care? Well, it's the fact that he has a terminal condition for which there are no treatments that is going to reverse that. He also had repeated hospitalizations for which he derived little to no benefit in a meaningful way for him. And his goals are to be with my mom and to not be in the hospital and to have his symptoms well treated through the end of life with attention to his well-being. And I think when you put all that together, that equals a hospice plan of care. Mm. So it's acknowledging kind of the situation. Hospice doesn't define the situation.
Right.
The situation that people find themselves in makes them wonder and search for how can we best move forward. Mm-hmm. Hospice is going to be the answer for a great number. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I really appreciate you sharing the perspective as a caregiver, because I imagine that's so different. You had approached a lot of your practice through the eyes of a provider, but now sort of being on the other side, what was that like?
It's been wonderful. One of the things that you will hear as a hospice and palliative care doctor, nurse, social worker, chaplain, volunteer, pharmacist, you will hear this sentiment. I certainly did. And that is, oh, that must be so difficult. Oh, why would you want to take care of people near the end of life? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so depressing. But the way I've distilled it down as a caregiver and as a son is that the sentiments that are shared with me as a doctor and as my hospice team or palliative care team, the sentiments that are shared with us are actually far better targeted at the caregiver. And I'm not saying that because I am a caregiver. Well, I guess I am, but it is a harder lift. And what I've come to recognize is that we are so very important for the caregivers, mm-hmm. because the caregivers need a medical team to hear their story. They need them to understand the story, the landscape of everything going on. And it's as though, as a caregiver, you're somewhat on trial. You know, you have to provide testimony. You have to think through things with the caregiving teams. And I remember asking at the hospital or at the assisted living, am I seeing things correctly? Mm-hmm. And I think some people might have experienced that to be unusual as a hospice doctor, that I'm asking them for their input. But yeah. I think that's one of the most important things is this idea of tentative questioning and having somebody to serve as a sounding board, a listening right. board, and give you insight is incredibly helpful no matter what your background is.
Yeah, so that they feel heard.
So you feel heard, but you also, there's two things that people experience, and that is caregivers oftentimes experience ambiguity and ambivalence. Mm. Am I right, and is this real? Mm. And it's hard sometimes when you're really close to a situation to be able to discern that. Mm-hmm. And so the role of professional caregiving teams, I think, is to listen to the caregivers and the patients and help them affirm or not whether something is real and if they are right in how they're interpreting things.
Yeah.
It's very helpful.
Do you find that some of the ambiguity is related to the misunderstanding of hospice and some of the misconceptions of what the service provides, that it's not so much giving up on your loved one? And I feel like that's sometimes the biggest challenge is dispelling some of those
yes.
misconceptions.
Well, there's a lot of misconceptions, and I can understand where this comes from.
Yeah.
You know, from the time we're born until the time we die, we always choose life. Mm. If we're in an accident, we call 911. If we're bleeding, we put pressure on it. We always choose life. And, you know, it's been well written about and studied that we are a death-denying culture. And, you know, but the fact is, we're all mortal. Mm. And when you are faced with a terminal condition in which you have ongoing functional decline, you may have some cognitive decline, your nutrition is not as good as it used to be, and you have a heavy symptom burden, without any treatment options that will reverse it, then choosing to live out life and choosing life looks different.
Yeah.
But it looks like, how do we live well? And what does the best care possible look like for me now? Mm-hmm. And just like with Barbara Bush or former President Carter, who's still alive and well and on hospice, focusing on their symptoms and their overall well-being, their emotional, spiritual, and social well-being helps people live better and longer. You know, earlier this week, I was with my parents and we were recounting all that we could be thankful for. Mm-hmm. And all that we could be grateful for. Because the time on hospice has been...
Yeah.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, we could cross T's and dot I's that we couldn't do from a hospital bedside. We could truly understand what was important, and we could make that happen. Mm-hmm. And you could say, well, you could do that without hospice. You certainly could, but I wouldn't recommend it. And the reason is this morning, you know, nurse called me. We made some changes. We got some medical equipment that showed up in a moment's notice. And we coordinated all that. We might change some medications. And if you don't do that with hospice, then you have to ask the question, How do you do that? Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to have to do something different than stay where you are mm-hmm. and be comfortable where you are, because hospice can care for you wherever you are. Mm-hmm. And when you have those thoughtful conversations and understand that the end of life is approaching, if you're searching for the best care possible, you will find hospice.
Yeah.
I think that's difficult for patients and families, but also the system is designed to respond in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of caregivers who are ultimately making the decisions by listening with the patients and families, and I think the question that we don't maybe pause long enough at is, you've experienced a number of crises. You know, you've had 3 hospitalizations and yeah. you don't seem to have gotten better from those hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. How do you see us responding the next time this happens?
Sure, yeah.
And a lot of people say, well, I just like to be where I'm at. I'd like to be with my wife at home. Oh, well, then how about we figure out how to do that? Mm. And ultimately, you'll arrive at hospice care.
All roads lead to Rome.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the common cultural narrative is that hospice causes somebody to die, when it's quite the contrary. The most common sentiments that I hear from hospice patients is that we wish we would have had hospice sooner. I think the other thing that's... we think of death, and death is a moment. It's a moment in time. It's an important moment. But for most patients and families, I'll say, you know, a year from now, when you're getting together for a family reunion, somebody will recognize that mom started this decline last fall. Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, yeah, that's for sure. And I'll say, that's because this time of life is called dying. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of this in our culture is the separating death from dying, because people are usually dying for quite a long while. And I think coupling that with what I hear from patients and families so often, that, you know, they wish they would have had hospice sooner.
Yeah.
And hospice was wonderful. I can't help but think that we're failing as a system to recognize when somebody is dying and at least start to have conversations.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned earlier just sharing gratitude moments with your father, I'm reminded that we don't have to wait until the end to do that. We should be doing this every day for our loved ones, not at the very end when it's all bunched together towards someone's ending. And I'm just wondering, is that part of the dignity-conserving therapies that you do, or can you share a little bit about what's entailed through that process?
So dignity-conserving care
and
dignity therapy. So we do research in dignity therapy here where we meet with patients and families and we ask them a series of questions that help them articulate the high points of their life and the messages that they'd like to convey to their loved ones. Yeah. And then we summarize that for them, allow some back and forth editing, and then present them with a legacy document for them and their families. And people are typically very happy to have received them. Mm. Dignity conserving care is something that I think it's at the core of medical care. And dignity is experienced by the patient and their family if they see themselves reflected in our eyes as the medical providers, the way they want to be seen. At the core, I think if you can be humble, be present, be vulnerable as another human being and listen, truly listen, I think that that will allow that individual to see themselves reflected in your eyes the way they see themselves and want to be seen by you. So that's a little bit of the work on dignity and what we teach.
I could see how that would be helpful, not just for the patients, but also the caregivers as well, that they feel heard and seen and that their dignity also deserves to be conserved in many ways. I mean, it's a different angle, but just showing your willingness to provide that type of care also indirectly provides it for the caregiver as well.
Well, I think, Dr. Chen, it extends into life in general.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm known to, you know, talk with the house cleaning staff, the volunteers, transport people. Everybody is important and they matter. And I think that's this modality of of being humble and present and vulnerable and listening to people is a good way of being in life.
That's so true. That's so true. It's a good life lesson. You've done such a great job of sharing how you approach these conversations and interactions. And I think I still struggle with, and I imagine a lot of other providers similarly, just the right words, especially towards last few moments of life. And how do you do that in a way that doesn't promote fear or avoidance? What is your approach towards doing it in a more disarming way?
Sometimes I'll ask learners, residents, fellows, and others,
sure.
What invitation do you think you're extending to the patient and family? Are you giving them the vibe that you've got other things to get to, or are you giving them the vibe that you're there and you just want to listen and be with? I think that's an important piece. I also think that most people want to talk about things that they are scared about, that they worry about. And in my experience, you can just ask, is there something you'd like to talk about? And I think one of the real skills, and this is under dialogue with listening, is to be quiet. Because when you ask that question, you know, you just can't ask it cold. You have to have some sort of context. You know, I'm so glad to be able to spend some time with you today. I've got some time here. I just want to check in with you and your family today and and say, you know, I don't have any agenda, or, you know, we could talk about anything you want to. Is there anything on your heart today that you want to talk about? And then if you ask a question like that, I say something jokingly, but I mean it. Sometimes we don't give patients as much time to respond to a serious question as maybe they would spend picking out a pair of shoes. You know what I mean?
That's true.
And so
we only have 10 minutes with them. Better talk fast.
And so I think giving them 30 seconds or a minute of just quiet. One of the things I teach is if you don't know what to say, don't say anything. And or just say you don't know what to say. And what
and
I've
that's okay.
And it's okay. And for me, I have to really think about this from time to time these days, more than before in my career, because people will ask me questions that I thought that they may have already known the answers to or that we'd already covered. And so I think for me that the term that I use a lot in recent years is this term of humble, tentative questioning, because so much comes out. And I think the tentative piece is important because it takes away any assumptions and it allows people to ask things that they may be thinking, well, this is too, I shouldn't ask the doctor this. I think there's also this component in a hospice and palliative care team, and certainly in my philosophy of how we practice, that topics of spirituality, existential questions, emotional well-being are not just topics left for social work, chaplaincy, and other staff. I think we need to enter into conversations with this fierce courage that whatever comes, we're going to welcome it. And so I think that aids in the conversations with patients and families to know that whatever they ask, whatever is on their heart, we can talk about. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm an expert in all of that, but it does mean that I can hold the conversation well enough to get them involved with one of my team members.
Right.
It also communicates to them that what they're saying is very important and that we care about that. And I think from a medical model, you could say, well, we could break that down into who does the spiritual screening or history or who does an assessment. Okay, so there's different roles for different team members, but none of the team members should shy away from it. And so I think it's about welcoming the hard conversations. And patients and families, in my experience, welcome that.
And then after you've taken all this in, absorbed it from your end, how do you then bring it back to them and instill hope back into a situation that seems hopeless to them?
So the reason people thank us is because we reassure them that they'll receive the best care possible through the end of life, period. Now, that doesn't mean that everything's going to go without a blemish. Mm. Things can be hard, but they know that we're there with them and that we're not going anywhere. And the term the best care possible is a beautiful term to use. And the reason I teach it is because everybody wants the best care possible. Right. Every person coming to Mayo Clinic or any clinic across the country, they want the best care possible. And I think it helps us all to have a common language, even when we're talking about the best care possible through the end of life. Mm-hmm. And language is so very important because it's not the best care possible at the end of life, because dying is a long time frame for most people these days. There are some people that die unexpectedly in a moment's notice from a trauma or something like that. But for most people, dying's a longer process. And to continually identify and tailor care to make sure they get the best care possible through the end of life is, I think, core to medical care. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can you share some stories or experiences that really stand out to you? I mean, you've had a long career so far, but anything about either end-of-life care or hospice, dignity-conserving therapy that was either life-changing or mindset-changing that can offer a little bit of inspiration or empowerment to our listeners?
What stands out to me is that there's growth and development through the end of life. And I think that's part of what we do in hospice and palliative care by supporting people with our interdisciplinary teams. I have been fortunate and grateful for the experience to witness so many people completing task of life completion. For example, one that really stands out to me was a son who had been incarcerated, and we were able to help him come to his father's bedside, and they had been estranged for many years. And I remember, like most families and like most people, the words don't come readily of what do you do now? And so I offered this young man the four things that matter most before you're forced to say goodbye. So please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. And I love you. And we were able to do that at his father's bedside. And the experience is one of peace and gratitude and a sense of completion. Mm. Not completion like life is over, but a sense of just well-being because life is good. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, these are things we should be doing all the time. Mm. Well, I agree. We should be living with our bags packed because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
What does aging well and living well mean through the eyes of the expert? I know you've talked about how your work has changed your approach to patient care, but how has being this type of provider impacted you as a whole, as well as your approach to life and to relationships?
Well, that's a big question. And I would say it's twofold for me. This work has taught me the importance of the harmony, and I don't use the word balance. I use the word harmony. And this is based a little bit on David White's book, The Three Marriages. And I think about the harmony between myself and what I would consider my calling, my vocation, my work, caring for patients and families. The relationship between myself and my loved ones. And then harmony between something that we don't necessarily teach in medical school, and that is between myself and the person I'm becoming. And having learned from patients and families through the years, the virtue that now stands out more than ever is the virtue of generosity. Mm. Being generous with your time, with your expertise, with your presence. For me, that's probably one of the biggest ways that my career has affected me is the virtue of generosity and being with.
Thank you again for being here. It was a wonderful learning opportunity, and I hope that our audience has found this to be valuable as well.
Yeah, thank you.
That's all for this episode. Hopefully you're feeling a little bit more informed, inspired, and empowered. And just so you know, we are taking a break because of the holiday season, but we'll be back in the new year with new topics and new guests. If you have a topic suggestion for a future episode,
you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. You might even feature your voice on the show. For more Aging Forward episodes and resources, head to mayoclinic.org/agingforward. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay curious and stay active.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.